But the very first of the dances just happened, thanks to Peter Albin's rich uncle, who owned the mansion at 1090 Page.
At 20 rooms. Or we rented 20. We rented out about 20 rooms. There were at least 50 to 60 people living there at any one time. It was insane.
Peter and Rodney Albin from Big Brother and the Holding Company talk about San Francisco's first ballroom, a very small one at 1090 Page.
There was a ballroom with an orchestra pit in the basement, you know, and Chet held his first dance there. He held four dances there.
There were actually like jam sessions, Wednesday night jam sessions that we had about four or five during the summer of 65.
Who was there first, you or Chet?
We lived there. I mean, right? We opened.
Chet never lived there.
He just ran his dances there.
How long had you had the place before the scene started? How long had you been living there?
It started almost immediately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at that time you had the feeling that you probably knew everybody who was in
right
the scene. You know, that was just about the last time you got that feeling. You know?
And in general, in that area, you could walk down the street and you could run into these people, and you know, even if you didn't know their names, you were very friendly.
Actually, a lot of people that I knew at that time lived in 1090 because there was a certain... Well, when I first came to San Francisco, it was very much of a party town. And there were parties every weekend, and they were all over town, and there was just circuits of people, and that's what people would do. It would be circulate between the parties, and everybody knew each other and so on. So there was a real link between a lot of these parties in State College and so on, and a lot of sort of boarding house trips, you know, and 1090 was a kind of boarding house.
Went through the earthquake. It was built in, what,
1898. Yeah, the house was in good condition. It was. Structurally, it was okay. There's a lot of vandalism that took place. Mm. Doorknobs.
The inscription over this one alcove was a musical thing. It's
let
music be the life of all of
us. Yeah, something like that.
Well, basically, I wanted to become a member of the group. I wanted to learn to play guitar. I didn't know any musicians. The only way that I knew, you know, to get any of that together was I just thought, well, call a bunch of musicians, start a jam session, you know, and so on and so forth, you know, find the guys who can play pretty good, you know, and put together a band. Like, basically what happened is that we tried to assemble musicians, and immediately that we got a few musicians together, you know, like one week there'd be say 35 musicians and 10 people in the audience, and then the next week there'd be 10 musicians, you know, and 35 people in the audience, and then there'd be 6 musicians and 50 people in the audience, and then there'd be seven or eight, you know, or six or five musicians, you know, and 200 people. Yeah. And pretty soon, you know, it got very outrageous for those times because, you know, people would crowd in there, and because it was a free form thing, it had no structure, and at first we charged no money. People would just sort of do whatever they did, you know, pull out their grass and smoke it, or you know, whatever. And that was one of the first places, you know, on a big scale that I remember that happening. The door was open, you know, and the music was blaring out the door, you know. So you never knew when just a couple of bluecoats were going to walk up to the door.
Like the YMCA of the Haight-Ashbury, you know, that it was known around the country. People would come in from, you know, Florida and Atlanta and New York. Really flipped a lot of people out. They'd come there and get into some heavy acid trip, or there were a couple of rooms where, you know, you rent a room to one junkie and all of a sudden you had 15 junkies living in a room. Huh. You know, tried to like clean them out, you know, yeah. These nests of junkies. Just because of the size of the place, so in that ballroom and whatnot, it did become kind of a social social center.
We had a ping pong table in the downstairs and a TV set, and it was like rec room.
We held them, I think, for about 10 weeks altogether, and that was just the beginning, kind of maybe psychedelic era, whatever you want to call it. And like there was still a pretty heavy element that would come to those things in terms of heavy, in terms of violence, you know, whatever. And, on about the 10th week, I walked up to the door and there was about, you know, 10 big guys, you know, all drunk, you know, and rowdy and, I don't know, totally out of line. And so I said, well, I guess you think I'm going to open the door and start this jam session, you know, and run this thing, you know, for your pleasure, you know, and so, but I'm not. it was interesting because the original motivation for charging 50 cents was that we naively thought that would limit people from coming. You know, we thought, well, if we charge them 50 cents, you know, that'll drive away, you know, the hangers-on, you know. But then it just established a value for it or something.
Chet was another, you know, was another kind of visionary character, you know. I remember him coming over one night before they'd done anything, you know. And he'd already flashed on the Toulouse-Lautrec poster thing, you know. He like really conceptualized that.
He was really, of course, obviously an important mover, and it was just, I guess, the style, Chet Helms' ethereal style, that was his greatest attribute and also his failing.
Chet Helms started the Avalon Ballroom and helped organize the Family Dog in 1966. After he started putting on shows, one of the first acts presented was Bo Diddley. Here's Bo from then.
I want everybody to clap your hands and stomp your feet. Come on. Have mercy. I want everybody to say amen. Have mercy.
I really don't know what got people into dancing either. That's really a question mark in my mind. But when we were part of that scene developing at 1090, getting people to dance, and I don't know exactly why, like all of a sudden people who were so much into sitting back and listening to Pretty Polly, or you know, some of the ballads like Ellen Faust, you know, some of the, you know, go on for hours, you know, these audiences eating that stuff up, all of a sudden that audience there was dancing up on their feet and doing not just, you know, dances they're told to do, like the twist and all that, and the commercial stuff, but just really doing wild things.
I liked to dance, you know, and that was a very free space. It was where my body, my mind, and my soul and everything felt free, you know. So I just tried to create a space and an environment around myself in which I could dance.
It hadn't occurred to us that we could go and dance and carry on. I don't know, it was a nice idea. Not a new one necessarily, but it was new to the scene.
Lynn Hughes, singer.
In the early 50s, there was that rockabilly music. And the early dances, where you went and tried to, you know, dance with partners and things. So at least it started out being a dancing scene. But jazz, there was nothing to dance to. It was very intellectual, like you said. Mm-hmm. So just from all of understanding it with your mind, the freedom that a real solid rhythm brought back, you know, the bass and the drum line mm-hmm. falling back into solidity, you know, made you want to move your feet or snap your fingers.
Right.
And I think LSD probably helped.
But dancing had always meant a structure. It was a basic step. You did the foxtrot, the jitterbug, the so-and-so, whatever, the two-step.
Bill Thompson, manager, Jefferson Airplane.
And that was completely blown apart with the San Francisco bands and the audiences. We were totally, it was such incredible energy many times in the old days between the audiences and the bands. The people just dancing everywhere, and the band would pick it up, and then they would throw out some more energy to the audience, and the audience would send it back to the band, and you could feel it.
There were three sisters that lived in the Haight-Ashbury that came to every single show. Beautiful, yet spaced out ladies, and very acidy, but always just wafted in, and some nights brought their things to do under the strobe lights, under the black light, the paints. Always very neat. They were the epitome of that whole era of that escapism world, and they were very sad and very lovely. They were all Mia Farrow.
Bill Graham.
They came to all the shows for years and years and danced under the strobe lights and just met other people. And it was one of the great things about the Z. People just walked in and started to dance with people. No hellos, no goodbyes, no what do you do, no names. Danced.
When, you know, the thing had just been starting and getting more visible, the Avalon Ballroom was happening, and those kind of things where you'd go and you'd take some acid and you just dance your ass.
Did you go?
for something that cemented a lot of minds.
Rock Scully, manager, Grateful Dead.
In other words, we were all kind of looking for something to get off on, a vehicle. And that ultimately led to the ballroom kind of scene with audio-visual tools, which was a rock and roll band and films, video, light shows. And see, we were reaching out and saying, look, there is a good time to be had. It's not like the 50s rock and roll. We're looking to have a good time. There's no harm in having some fun, which I was raised to believe was harmful, to have fun. It's difficult to say that fun should be our ultimate expression, because so much of the world is not fun. It is serious and it is real. But this music, this new music, was communicating that very fact. You know, it was saying, look, there is another way to see the world, and we don't have to be serious beatniks either. We don't have to throw it all away. We can use what is already thrown away and create something really beautiful out of it. We had taken a slightly more formalized step in that we had gone from the parties to the Meme Troop benefits, which were more organized parties, where there were people from all over the city, a lot of whom we didn't know. And we were charging admission. Right around that time, between the first and second Meme Troop benefits, we had our first family dog benefit, because what we were doing was helping out a bunch of broke people, myself included.
A bunch of us went to a Rolling Stones concert at the Cow Palace. And afterwards, sitting around somebody's pad, talking about the show and saying, gee, how great it was, but it would have been super if you could just dance.
Bob Cohen, co-founder of the Avalon Ballroom.
And that actually was the first remembrance I have of how the Avalon and how the dances started. Uh-huh. Somebody there saying, well, why don't we have our own dance? And somebody else saying, well, that'd be a disaster, because it would turn into some kind of a rumble, you know. And we thought, well, let's just invite all the people we know. And we'll just advertise it, like with posters, you know, or something like that. And the first, we did it, and it turned out to be the very first dance at the Longshoremen's Hall. I think the very first one was Jefferson Airplane, Great Society, and the Marbles.
We all know who the Jefferson Airplane and the Great Society were, but what about the Marbles? The Marbles were a Berkeley band that eventually evolved into the Loading Zone. And the Loading Zone made one record for RCA later that had this cut on it.
Ben Van Meter takes us up to the Light Show Bridge when What Was That? And the Rise of the Ballrooms continues after this break. You're listening to What Was That? Or Suddenly Lost Summer, and I want to tell you what's coming up because people have called and they want to know. Right now we're listening to Bonnie's segment on the ballrooms in San Francisco in the 60s, and we're going to be going into the light shows. And the concession folks who put a little surprise in your orangeade. Around 7:30 or so, an introductory flashback to KMPX. And then we're going to have the ultimate dance concert tonight with live tapes incredible rarity recorded at the time on the scene. The Dead, The Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, and astounding unreleased material by Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janis Joplin. And this is what's going to be on the concert. First hour, The Airplane and the Doors. Second hour, Big Brother, Steve Miller, and Mother Earth. Third hour, The Byrds, Moby Grape, Mothers, Santana, and Country Joe. And in the fourth hour, Creedence and Quicksilver, The Dead, and Janis Joplin. Tomorrow, there'll be a closer look at folks who came to San Francisco's third-year party. And there'll be more concerts, an interview, or should we say a statement, from Ken Kesey and those Miri pranksters. Back to the ballrooms. And again, you're listening to KSAN in San Francisco.
We were making a formalized approach towards it like a business, and charging admission and trying to make ends meet and so on, which we couldn't do. We lost money the first one.
We went from there to the Longshoremen's Hall to do the first big gig.
Matthew Cates, who managed the first Jefferson Airplane, started Moby Grape and It's a Beautiful Day.
And that was the first family dog dance that was organized by Loria Costell and Ellen Harmon. And we wrote an agreement on a napkin, and it was a $300 agreement for Jefferson Airplane to perform as considered to be the lead performing act. And they had so many guards at the Longshoremen's that it cost so much money, and there were so many people that came and got in free, that, well, I actually loaned them a few $100 over and above to help them with debts, because they not only couldn't pay the $300, they couldn't pay anybody anything, but it was a great success.
And we broke even the second one, and we made some money the third one. And it was after the third one that Luria stepped out of it. It just wasn't worth it.
The whole scene of the Family Dog was a much more homey, cozy type of trip. It wasn't a psychedelic, freak-out palace of things.
Luria Castell, co-founder of Family Dog.
And so we wanted an old-timey vignette kind of thing for our dances. Now, I think you have to examine why people gather. Why people gather publicly in large groups. Do they do it just because it's the thing to do on Friday and Saturday night, or are they a little more precious than that? Do they have a soul? Do they have an aura? Do they have energy that they can give off? Now, I think anybody who's listened to that music live is very, very aware that there's a tremendous amount of juice that comes off a band, a good band, you know. But then where does it go, man? It floats out, and nothing's done with it. Now, I mean, I've gotten high enough, and all my friends have, to dig that when people get in there, that they can take that juice and add their own juice to it and get off with it. Now, they can raise it up, you know. I believe people have souls, you know, and I think that one of the reasons you go to a place together and spend your time, because your time is precious, is to do something with it. And I think that music could have done a lot more than just entertain. I think it could have raised the level of everything.
These things created an awful lot of trouble, and by that I mean internally, with people saying, well, you didn't do your job and we didn't sell enough tickets and this, that, and the other thing. We were up against, if you looked at it strictly commercially, we were up against these wild men from the peninsula, the pranksters, with this totally bizarre event called the Acid Test. On the event of our first California Hall concert was the first time the Acid Test had come to the city, and they were over at the Fillmore Hall. And when they came to town, I saw it as competition. To me, it seemed like we better hook up with these guys, you know? And so we formed a double ticket price, where if you bought a ticket to our thing, you could go to their thing. And if you bought a ticket to their thing, they could come to our thing. And we ran a bus between the two places. And once they got there, we were making announcements from the stage at California Hall that they could go over to the Fillmore if they wanted to with their ticket. And they were doing the same over at the Fillmore. But at the Fillmore, nobody was leaving. See? As a matter of fact, once I left California Hall, I didn't come back. Because when I got over there, the Grateful Dead were playing. And they were raising the roof. And I fell in love with that band. I'd seen them already twice on the peninsula. And just, one of the most fascinating things about the Rolling Stones were those early photos that came from New York on their arrival out at the airport. There were pictures taken in New York. And boy, did they look ugly. You know, and it was that mystique of these long, ugly guys making that incredible music, you know. And here were guys that were even uglier than the Rolling Stones, you know. And I was saying to myself, these guys will never make it commercially. The Dead didn't care what the thing looked like. You know, they had Pigpen. They didn't need to look like anything but have Pigpen standing there at that Fender Rhodes, you know.
They were weird. They would always have to have us turn off the strobe light for their set, you know, because they couldn't. Pigpen wouldn't be able to see the keys, you know. Turn off the strobe!
Mountain Girl, from the Pranksters, and from the Grateful Dead.
And, they'd play and they'd be so loud, just devastatingly loud, and it would be such a relief when they finally stopped.
They were bad looking, and they really played heavy duty rock and roll, and they played a lot of that stuff that was making the Stones so popular, Little Red Rooster and all that, you know, nitty gritty blues. Well, this
was four dances, and then I decided this wasn't for me and moved to Big Sur and spent the winter in Big Sur. And then the first inkling I had of anything going on was getting a letter from a friend of mine saying, get your ass up to San Francisco, there's a whole bunch of things happening, you know, you're gonna miss the boat kind of thing. So I came up to San Francisco to take a look, and I went to look up my old friends, and I was introduced to Chet Helms. And he said, well, look, I'm looking for someone to help me with the sound, and I'm putting on a show at the Fillmore. So I was there one day and had a job. That weekend, we did the Tribal Stomp, which was the first dance at the Fillmore, and we alternated weeks with Bill Graham.
We had a handshake agreement for a while there, to every other weekend in the Fillmore. And,
How did Graham get control of the Fillmore solely?
Solely? Well, he had, at the point when John and I got into it, he had contracted to lisathine. Telling some of those guys, I think, tell the story that how he got onto it was that they turned him onto it. But again, it's one of those things, who finds what first, you know? And it's all nonsense, man. Particularly at this late day.
Now, one of the great arguments that I never want to become an argument, Gleason always said to everyone, Graham didn't find the film well, I told him to go over there. And I said, okay. It's like somebody said, you didn't throw the first dance. I didn't say I found the first. I didn't say I found the film. I didn't say that. I didn't say I did the first poster. I never said those things. Maybe Ralph did, I don't remember, but I did go and see the Fillmore, and it was bigger than the loft, and this black guy, Charles Sullivan, had the lease on it, and I paid him $60 to use, and he kept the concessions.
The late Ralph Gleason.
The reason that the Fillmore dances began at the Fillmore on Geary Street was that the Meme Troupe wanted to have a benefit. Bill had a benefit for them at the Meme Troupe's own studio down on, I think it was Howard Street. Right. And that place was pretty small, and they wanted to have another one. And in a phone conversation with Bill, I suggested they rent the old Fillmore Ballroom, which had been there for 100 years.
Chet was very instrumental in conceptualizing what was... In fact, he was the one that did all the conceptualizing. what was going to happen in the imagery, you know. And it was just very natural. I mean, we weren't working from any set of rules or anything. We were doing what we felt everybody would like. My job at the dance was to mix the sound, but I mainly danced, you know, and go back every so often and adjust things. People would interview us and ask us, you know, like where we got the idea or the, what they call a gimmick, and I couldn't relate to that. You know, well, you know, what gimmick? There's no gimmick. We're just doing what's natural, man. We're enjoying ourselves, you know. There was no plan. Bill Graham had maybe the best plan of anybody, you know. He seemed to always be on the outside so he could stand back and take an objective look at what was really happening. And he had a much broader background coming from New York, theater in New York, and he could see a lot more, you know, where we were just doing it.
I'd have to say I was an outsider because I was very much involved in making my thing work. And I looked at it, at the scene in general, as a group of blind people with wonderful, warm, honest dreams and fantasizing. The majority of them just fantasize. They refuse to accept reality. I don't say just accept it. I say accept the fact that it exists and then deal with it. But you can't say there is no war, and you can't say we shall overcome, and then say it again and again. You've got to try to do something about it. And I've said it too many times before, but the best way I know how to explain that era, and I don't want to, it always sounds negative when I talk about it, but it's sadness rather than negativity, that they did very little. There was so much talk and so much movement, physical movement, but there was very little doing. And the couple was always, you know, Nixon or Washington or the Fuzz, man. Oh, I can't get a gig, you know. Nobody wants to hire a hippie. Well, cut your f***ing hair. But yet the world's got to accept you in all the ways that you are and you've become and feed you. And I got to stop because I always get hard about those days because what I didn't understand is, could there be that many idiots? Could there be so many, that much lost, that far away from seeing reality? You can't always put down your neighbor who's got a crew cut and say you can't talk to him. Why? Because you don't want to talk to him? And would you cut your hair if that would make it possible for you to talk to him? Then maybe you got to change before you expect him to change. And the guy down on Montgomery Street isn't a and he isn't a cop-out, because he's got more going for him than he's got for you, because he feeds his family. And you don't even talk to your parents, because they got short hair too. There was so much talk about love, and if you talk to them, and I accept something now that I didn't then I had much more bad feelings, because like, why are these people that way? Now I have a little more understanding, because they were new at this escapism of theirs also. And the typical 20-year-old chick who's, when I said, do you talk to your parents? No, why not? They don't understand me. They don't understand the freedom that I want to feel and the changes I want to make in this world. But why not talk to them? And I never understood why you could take the kids out of the Haight-Ashbury, the majority of them. I said, do you have sisters and brothers? Yes. Do you talk to them? No. Do you have parents? Yes. Do you talk to them? No. Do you have cousins? Yes. Do you talk to them? No. Who do you relate to? Well, my friend Debbie and I, you know, trip out and we do our thing. I never understood that.
She would never say where she came from. Yesterday don't matter if it's gone. While the sun is bright or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and goes. Why she needs to be so free. She'll tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained and nothing. things lost at such a cost. There's no time to lose, I heard her say. Catch your dreams before they slip away. Dying all the time, lose your dreams and you will lose your mind. In life unkind.
Started out, it was a little bit in the beginning more like theater. There was the lights, there was the music, there was a total environment. There was a fluorescent chalk, the strobe light, and kids would walk in there, you know, just had literally have their minds blown. If not, also by having someone give them a tab of acid and say, have a good evening.
I think they're calling us.
Benefit, at the first benefit at the Loft, all of a sudden there was Bob Nelson with film loops, Ben Van Meter, and guys with liquid things, and this was at the Loft. And then at the very first, when I found the Fillmore, they said, can we come? And I said, well, what are you going to project against? Well, we'll put up a bed sheet. And all of a sudden, from the very first show, it was almost like you sit down to a table, you need a knife and fork. Well, you want to do a rock show, got to have a bed sheet. I think at the beginning they just wanted costs. I don't remember at the beginning. There was no pattern, and maybe $10.
Well, you'd get there about 7 o'clock with the materials, having prepared for, say, on Friday night, for a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night gig. Having spent the past 2 or 3 days preparing new materials, since we were the house show, we had to have a lot of new materials every week. So we made slides, copied things out of photographs, out of books, as slides, painted slides, made film loops, both film that we made and scrap film that we painted on, scratched on, punched holes in, accumulated materials other ways, made mats for the overhead projectors, repaired the equipment that had burned out the week before, got everything all clean and ready to go. Our show had grown. It grew. We got a little more money at the Avalon than could have ever gotten at the Fillmore. And although we were never paid, even when the light show was at its height, at its zenith, we were never paid anywhere near as much as the third band on each bill. Right? But managed to build it up in the 14 months we were there to 6,000 watt overhead projectors and banks of 2, each with dimmers, each with its set of clock face plates and liquids. One artist on each of those 3 setups of overhead projectors, a dozen Kodak carousels on Lazy Susans and remote controls, 3 or 4 Graflex 16 millimeter projectors, 2 Super 8 projectors, a giant strobe light, a theatrical spotlight, and this incredible machine that we called the Moray Cannon that somebody had talked Chet Helms into building for him. It was made out of solid steel. It was incredible. Made out of solid steel. It was rotated 2 drums in opposite directions, 2 circular drums that you put circular Moray patterns from Edmund Scientific Company on and project it through. And it worked, but it was solid steel, and he hadn't put the little rubber things where he drilled through the metal, ran the wire, and we were all afraid of getting electrocuted on it. The fear of getting electrocuted was a constant thing, because you were working with wet hands from the liquids and have to run over to fix a projector that had atrophied it. Often get 110 volts and jump back and dry your hands and then go ahead and fix it. And fuses blowing continually because the places were never wired. Even the Avalon was never rewired to accommodate the light show. Mm-hmm. A few more lines were brought in from the existing service, but we were continually in danger of blowing fuses, having to run down and change fuses with wet hands. Mm-hmm. And some of the early equipment we had were like those old lantern slide projectors with glass. And those were ancient and got burning physically hot as well as possible electrocution. But we worked hard from the time the music started, like there were three bands every night playing two sets each of, say, 45 minutes, but only one light show. And the light show was essentially visual panorama, collage, changing continually in time to the music and hopefully with the mood of the music. And it was hard work. And we had six artists working at the height of it. Six artists and two dishwashers. The regular job at the Avalon was 200. No, he never would pay us 200 a night. 190 a night, which we divided up, you know, like 15 or 20 bucks each, and the rest to maintain the show, buy it, make new materials, and pay for the equipment. But we got a few jobs out that were 500 a night. Mm-hmm. That was about as much. 750, I think I got one time. But you know, that's what the lowest band on a three. You know,
right.
That's what the Flaming Groovies got in 1967.
The problem with the low pay for the light shows came to a head in 1969 when Bill Graham confronted a unified front of striking light shows. After that meeting, light shows as an art form passed from the scene.
Well, that's the meeting that Chet started by throwing the I Ching. I said, oh, God, I wanted to pull up my dice. I was really angry. I was blackmailed a bit. They didn't want to understand. They were no draw. It was nice to have you. But whatever we pay you is because we think light shows are good. If you don't want to do it, I'm sorry, that's all we can afford. And they wanted certain rates, unions, fine. And it was proven, I'm sorry to say that, when the light show stopped, the attendance didn't change.
We'll have more of What Was That after this.